Hi there, and welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and today we are featuring a listener favorite, one of the most talked about episodes we have released. I'm joined by Donna Henderson, a clinical neuropsychologist with deep expertise in the subtle ways autism presents in girls and women. If you've ever had a gut feeling that something is being missed, this episode is for you. I'm going to dive into a powerful conversation that continues to resonate with parents and professionals alike. Let's get started.
Hi there. Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. Our episode today will focus on girls and women with autism. Today's conversation was with Dr. Donna Henderson. And speaking with Dr. Henderson prior to coming on and being a guest on our podcast, and in speaking with other young adults, women in particular, that are diagnosed with autism, I've heard things such as socializing fills me with anxiety, or it's like all my senses are firing at once. And so we know that autistic women and girls are hugely misunderstood. So I'm hoping that in speaking with Dr. Henderson today, we can clear up some of the misconceptions and we can bring some brighter light to supporting girls and women with autism. Before I get started, I'm going to read a little bit about Dr. Henderson. She's been a clinical neuropsychologist for 25 years, and she first worked as a staff neuropsychologist and then a director of acquired brain injury at the Gaylord Hospital in Connecticut. After taking a break to stay home with her three children, she joined the StickRude group in 2011. She specializes in neuropsychology evaluations for individuals with cognitive, academic, social, and/or emotional challenges, with a particular specialty in autism. Dr. Henderson is a frequent lecturer on the subtle presentations of autism, on girls and women with autism, and on parenting children with complex profiles. Welcome, Dr. Henderson.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. What got you interested in working with this population?
So it's kind of funny. I didn't have any training in working with people with autism, and I didn't have any particular interest in it either. It started about 10 years ago, actually. I'm a neuropsychologist, and I was doing evaluations for people who have ADHD and learning disabilities or language problems. And I really naively thought, well, I don't really do autism. You know, if somebody with autism comes into my office, I'm competent to test them. But otherwise, it's just sort of not my area. I'm a bit older. I finished my training before Asperger's was added to the DSM. And so when I went through my training, the concept of autism was more along the lines of classic autism, people who are quite impaired and obvious. So anyway, about 10 years ago, I was working with this brilliant young woman. She was in 12th grade. She came from a very affluent and well-educated family. And she had had lifelong problems with ADHD, anxiety, and depression. And because her parents were so resourceful, she was at, you know, the best private school. She had the best therapist. She had had neuropsych evals a few times before, mostly for her ADHD. And they all basically said the same thing. She has ADHD, she has anxiety, she has depression. And she had been medicated for all of that and everything. So now she was in 12th grade, and I was evaluating her just for accommodations for college. It was supposed to be, you know, nobody was expecting any surprises. And so I'm working with her, and she was working on a math problem or something. So I had a minute to just sit there and wait and watch her. And I found myself thinking, God, I don't like her. Yeah, I'm not proud to admit this. Most of the time, I actually really like the kids I work with. Even the ones who are quirky or difficult, like I don't have that reaction a whole lot. And so I took a moment to sort of check myself and see, well, what's going on here? And I realized that I couldn't connect with her at all. She was hard to connect with. And I thought, well, of course, she's really, really depressed. And depressed people can be hard to connect with. They don't give you much back. And they sort of have this low energy. But I realized it's more than that. She's really arrogant. I mean, she was really arrogant. I would, you know, introduce a task and she would say, lovely. Or she would, you know, I would say something like, okay, now we're going to, you know, sound out some nonsense words. And she would say, nonsense words. And so it was very awful.
No social engagement, right? Just no little breadcrumbs that you're dropping for these social cues and she's not picking them up.
Exactly. And, you know, I sort of assumed, okay, so she's got depression. She's unbelievably brilliant. The girl was no doubt smarter than I was. She came from a very, very affluent family, father, a well-known litigator. And maybe it's something related to all of that, you know, her background. Anyway, I kept thinking about it as she was working. And within 2 minutes, I had an aha moment. She has autism. This is a different presentation of autism than I've ever seen or even heard about. And I don't know what caused that to click in my mind, but as soon as it did, I thought, oh, I'm onto something here. I need to follow through on this. So I asked her parents to bring in all of her old report cards. I had her old neuropsych evals, and I went through it all with a fine-tooth comb, and I found so much evidence of autism. Things like in her old eval, one of them, somebody said she was lacking in spontaneity with respect to affect. Very odd wording, but you know, basically they were saying she had flat affect, right? And this was before her depression had hit. I then interviewed her parents a little more deeply, and her mother remembered her first grade teacher saying, well, if she keeps talking to people like that, she's never going to have any friends. And her mother also said things like, well, she won't throw anything away, even old gum wrappers. I mean, I got so much evidence of autism. So I called the therapist, and her therapist had been seeing her for about 7 years, a very well-known, well-respected, smart therapist, somebody I personally really like. And I said to the therapist, I think she has autism. And the therapist said to me, yeah, you're pretty much nuts. She completely disagreed with me, and my confidence dropped. But I thought, well, I'm still going to pitch it to the parents. I can't just let it drop. So the father, as I said, was a really well-known litigator. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be like interrogated. And I was interrogated for 2 hours. I was not at all prepared for it because I knew very little about autism. But we went through the diagnostic criteria, and in the end, he agreed with me. And then he took a bathroom break, and his lovely wife leaned forward. She had been quiet the whole time. I had no idea what she was thinking. She leaned forward and said, you're right, she has it, and he has it too.
Oh my goodness.
It was my second aha moment for this case. Like, because he's so high functioning and brilliant, autism never crossed my mind. Now, of course, I see it all the time in people who are high functioning in their fields. So anyway, that was sort of a pivotal case for me because it was the first time I realized that girls and women can present with autism in very subtle ways.
So do we know why it's harder to identify girls? And how does it look different for girls than it does for boys, right? And because if we look at kind of the research and what's coming up, more than 4 boys for every autistic girl. Is that sound familiar? Is kind of something that I ran across in terms of diagnoses. And so how do they present so differently?
So the 4-to-1 ratio has been out there for a while. Although very recently I heard it's moving towards 3-to-1 now. But the important thing to know is at the lower end of the spectrum, and I know that the phrases lower end of the spectrum and higher end of the spectrum are controversial, and I get the reasons they are, but I'm going to use them because I haven't found anything better. So kids at the lower end of the spectrum, that's kids maybe with lower IQ, more repetitive behaviors, just more impaired. The ratio is more like 2-to-1. And
right.
At the very high end of the spectrum, I call it the neurotypical end of the spectrum, it's really much bigger. It can be as much as 9-to-1. It's girls at the high end of the spectrum that are being missed. Girls at the low end of the spectrum, not as much.
And they're almost just being kind of, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but hiding in plain sight, right? Because you said there's just such subtle differences that people are saying, oh, it's ADHD or is it depression or, you know, and then being impacted with eating disorder. And so really just there's a lot of nuance within that.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons that they're getting missed is that we call it misattribution of symptoms or diagnostic overshadowing, because these girls get another diagnosis first. It's usually either ADHD or anxiety or both. And then everybody blames the social problems on the ADHD and or the anxiety. Everybody says, oh, well, of course she's not doing well socially. She's incredibly anxious.
Right. And then so clinicians say that girls and women, they don't meet this DSM criteria. So what is the cost of this misdiagnosis? Because you're saying, you know, there's these subtleties and then the social aspect, and it's kind of pushed off on, you know, is it anxiety? Is it ADHD? Is it depression? And that's why there's this disconnect socially, or this, you know, slight disconnect. So then what is the cost of that misdiagnosis? You know, some say they meet the criteria, some say they don't. So can you kind of go into what that criteria is and what the difference is?
Sure, absolutely. So you're bringing up a few points. The first is, what's the cost of the misdiagnosis? And the answer is, it's huge. And people ask me that sometimes. They say, well, if these girls present in such a subtle way, do they even need the diagnosis? Is it even important? And the answer is, absolutely, it is. When I say subtle, I mean that their symptoms are subtle compared to people with classic autism, in that you won't...
The symptoms are not subtle within themselves, right? So if you're comparing these very impaired elements, and that it is subtle, but it's not subtle to their world and the success of what they experience within the world.
Right. And it's not subtle compared to typically developing girls at all. And these girls with autism, have sky high rates of anxiety. They have very high rates of depression. They have high rates of eating disorders. They tend to have GI problems frequently or other somatic symptoms. So they can be transgender, and I don't mean to lump transgender in with mental health issues like anxiety and depression, except that being transgender when you're a teenager especially is incredibly stressful. So it's one more stressor in the mix. So yeah, they often have a lot going on. It's very, very, very hard to be a girl or an adolescent or a young woman with Asperger's. And it's harder if it's undiagnosed because nobody understands what's going on with you. And just like what happened with me and that one girl, you know, her whole life, everybody thought she was incredibly arrogant and people didn't like her. And once people understood that she had autism, there was a lot more patience and understanding. So getting that clarity is incredibly important. I want to address something else you said, actually. You said you've heard that girls don't meet the criteria, but... And I've heard that too. I hear other clinicians sometimes saying, oh yeah, I know. I get that girls don't meet the criteria. First of all, when we say criteria, we're talking about the DSM-5. And I am a very strong believer that they do meet the criteria if you know what to look for and how to look for it. I have never and would never diagnose someone with autism unless they meet the diagnostic criteria with the DSM-5. And I find that a lot of clinicians don't know how to interpret those criteria for girls.
And how is that? You know, I know when all the testing or research came out originally that the norms were based on males. Is that right? In terms of diagnostic criteria and symptoms. And so what are those differences? Like if we ran through the symptoms that are listed in the DSM-5 for criteria, can you kind of walk us through those symptoms and how they present differently for girls and women versus boys and men?
Sure, absolutely. So DSM criteria, the majority of them are divided into two categories. The first category are social and communication problems. And there are three criteria in that category. And somebody has to meet all three of those criteria.
Okay.
So you have to meet them currently or by history. So if a girl had significant difficulties when she was 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, and now she's 14 and she's camouflaging and doing well in on one of these criteria, it still counts. If you can prove by history that she has these difficulties, it still counts. So it's currently or by history. And the second thing to keep in mind is that a lot of it's important to assess what they're like when they're interacting with same age peers. Because a lot of times these kids can do incredibly well with adults or much older kids. They can also do quite well with much younger kids. that you really have to get at what they're like with their peers and think about that as we talk about the criteria.
And wouldn't that go also just in different settings, right? So it's not just how they present in one particular setting, but throughout different settings that the symptoms are still clear.
For sure. Although a lot of these girls do really, really well at home or with people that they know and they're comfortable with. But as soon as you put them in a new setting with new people, they hit a wall. They can't do it. And the reverse is true, where some of these girls camouflage really, really well out in the community, and their teachers think they're just the best students on the planet and the most well-behaved, the sweetest, the most polite, perfect students. But then they go home and completely fall apart. It's totally Jekyll and Hyde, because the cost of all that camouflaging all day long is too much. And so certainly some girls, you can see it, see the problems both at home and at school, but you really a lot of times see it one or the other. Does that make sense?
It does. And how does that work kind of from a brain standpoint in terms of being able to hold it in during the day and then fall apart at night or vice versa? And then how does that just from like a systemic brain processing?
So women with autism, with Asperger's, have been telling us for a long time, I can pass for neurotypical, but I am thinking my way through the social interaction the whole time. And now neuroimaging shows us that exactly what they're saying is true, that they are. So when you and I, Wendy, we're both neurotypical. And when we're exchanging social niceties, our frontal lobe is not working very hard, right? It's sort of just relaxing. There's no planning. There's no decision making, right? We may or may not be enjoying it, but it's fairly effortless for most of us. But if I'm a woman with Asperger's, and I'm sorry, I know it's not a technical diagnosis anymore, but I still informally use the term Asperger's for this group. When I'm engaging in social interactions and social niceties, my frontal lobe lights up on neuroimaging. It's working hard. I'm thinking my way through the interaction. And so for these women, if your frontal lobe is working hard just to get through the social piece, there's less energy left over for the executive functioning piece. And they do have poor attention and executive functioning. And that may be one reason why. And we know there a lot of them talk about this. They're kind of remembering the rules. And I've had so many girls and women with autism who their parents say, oh, no, her eye contact is fine. And I think her eye contact is fine. But when I say to her, what is eye contact like for you? She'll say, oh, it's really hard. I have to concentrate on it. I find it distracting. I find it effortful. Sometimes I forget. Just yesterday, a lovely girl, she's 14, super smart, incredibly anxious. I'm sure she has autism. And I asked her about eye contact and she said, yeah, sometimes I forget to make eye contact. I really have to work hard on reminding myself. And as a neurotypical woman, you would never have to remind yourself to make
eye contact. Oh, and that's exhausting, right? That you're just constantly going through this checklist in your head of what's appropriate behavior and really not taking that moment to filter in and enjoy almost, right? Like enjoy just being in the moment and having a conversation that you're constantly just working so hard to remember, am I looking somebody in the eye? Am I smiling? Am I asking questions? Am I showing empathy? You know, just this whole process. It right. has to be. Yeah. So now I can see where if you're holding it together all day, by the time you get home, you're exhausted. So I can't imagine adding the other kid layers on that if you're in some sort of activity after school or you have homework or any of these things are just kind of home life responsibilities as a kid, that pressure is not really released. Oh. And so then it could look like depression and all of these other things because it's just this intense experience, I would think, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's exhausting. Can I tell you a story?
Absolutely. I love stories.
Okay. So this story, there's a girl, let's just call her Jane, and she came from a family that liked to hike a lot. And her mom told me that as they were growing up, you know, when you're hiking and there aren't a lot of people on the trail and you pass right. people, you say hello or you nod, you say good morning, you know. And this woman's other two children would always do that. They caught on pretty early. But this girl, Jane, never said hello to people on the hiking trail. And the mom had mentioned that to me. So Jane is brilliant. I mean, absolutely effortlessly straight A student. So she and her mom were walking into a supermarket one day, and they passed a family that they didn't know, that they knew well, but hadn't seen for about a year. And the mom stopped to chat, and Jane just kept walking. She didn't say hello, even though they had a same age girl who had been in the same Girl Scout troop and class and everything. So when the mom caught up to Jane, she said, hey, how come you didn't say hello to Abby? And Jane said, well, I don't know Abby. And the mom said, well, of course you do. Like, have you been in her kitchen? Does she know the name of our dog? You know, of course you know her. You've had play dates with her. And Jane said, well, yeah, but I haven't seen her for a year. And the mom said, yeah, but the rule is if you know someone and haven't seen them for a while, you say hello, especially if you haven't seen them for a while, you say hello. And now they were in the supermarket, and Jane said, okay, so now we're in the supermarket. Is this like the hiking trail where I say hello to everybody? And the mom said, no, that would be really weird. You don't say hi to everyone in the
So many rules, right? So many rules to kind of keep
Jane, right. Jane burst into tears. This brilliant girl just sobbed right then and there. And those were her exact words, Wendy. There are so many secret rules. How am I supposed to keep track of all of this?
And you said it, I mean, what an excellent story to depict that, right? Because it's like, we're on a hiking trail, you can say hi to anybody, you know them or not know them. We're in the grocery store, you don't say hi to people you don't know, but you do say hi to people that you haven't seen in a while, or you can give a friendly nod of somebody you don't know because there was an exchange and, you know, your shopping cart go by. And yeah, there's just so many layers to that.
You don't give them as rules, and neither do I. Totally intuitive, and it takes almost zero brain power, right? I mean, if you're tired and you're not in the mood, that's one thing. But for the most part, for these girls, that's what's going on underneath. And that's why it's so important for everybody to understand this is autism. This is really hard for them. We need to support them.
So let's go back kind of to the DSM symptoms, the criteria. Yeah, no. So go back to the first three that we were saying, but you're absolutely right in terms of this. And it's just fascinating because I can see where things are easily overlooked without that knowledge. And boy, that knowledge is powerful, right?
Right. So the first three criteria are social and communication problems. The first one is reciprocity, the ability to engage in reciprocal social and emotional interactions. And that includes so much. It includes intuitively greeting people, responding to greetings, knowing how to initiate conversations, knowing how to respond when other people initiate conversations. The whole idea of being reciprocal, meaning if I say, the weirdest thing happened to me last night, you would say,
what was it? Oh my gosh, I can't wait to hear this.
Right.
Where are you? Tell me all the details.
Well, that's a lot of reciprocity.
You know, it's a version of that.
That you're an interviewer, so that makes sense. So, no, I mean, that's how two people build a conversation. Each person builds on what the other person said. They're not each in their own lane. They're doing it together. And if you don't pick up what the other person says and build on it, you're not going to have a truly reciprocal conversation.
Right. It's so good you say that in terms of just thinking of like being in your own lane in that social communication world, but really trying to stretch out of your lane to put touches of these rules out there, kind of sprinkles of these rules out there, so you still can look like you're blending or camouflaging.
Right. Or actually genuinely having a real conversation where you're genuinely showing interest in what the other person has to say, not just faking it. And so, I mean, this is true for boys and girls, but with girls, it's so much more subtle because they do learn to kind of sort of camouflage. So for instance, if you're a parent or teacher on the edge of a playground and you're watching the children play from a distance, there's research showing that boys with autism are more obviously loners on the playground, where girls with autism are in the group. So from a distance, it looks like they're integrating with others. But when you get up close and personal, they're actually not really truly integrating. It just looks like they are from the distance.
Wow.
I'm reminded of a story, if I can tell another story. I was giving a talk on girls with autism once to a group of colleagues. And this one young man, whose name is Eric, and he had run a lot of peers groups, tons of peers groups. It's a social skills group. and he knows autism really well. And I was talking about this topic and he got really, really excited. And I said, what's going on? And he said, you know, every time we run a peers group, the first night, it's always clear to me why the boys are there. And with some of the girls, it's clear why they're there. But there's always one or two girls and I think it's a mistake. She shouldn't be here. And the first session and the second session and sometimes even the third session go by and I think, who put this girl in a social skills group? She shouldn't be here. But sooner or later, I see it. It just takes those girls a lot longer for me to see it. It was really validating for me to hear that.
What is validating, because then it really kind of emphasizes our conversation today in terms of the cost of misdiagnosis, right? So we talk about social communication. What are the other elements in that?
That the first one of the three in the social communication, the second one is about relationships. And people think it's just, you know, can she make friends and can she keep friends? And it's so much more complicated than that. First of all, making and keeping friends are fundamentally different. Because I have a lot of kids who have their friends from preschool that basically the moms got the kids together. And if the families live in the same neighborhood or go to the same synagogue or whatever it is, they, you know, those groups sort of stay together. But if that kid has not made a new friend since preschool and she's now in ninth grade, the fact that she's got those friends isn't necessarily a rule out for autism, right? Because she's not making new friends. And the reverse is true. I see girls sometimes where they always have friends. And if I just say to the parents, does she have friends? They'll say, yeah, she always has friends. Right. Well, they turn over. She can't keep friends, you know? And then you have to also get into where is the nature of her friendships? Are they always with girls who are 3 years younger? Are they always with, you know, girls who are clearly on the spectrum or have other challenges? Or are they always with bullies? Are they constantly in sort of these frenemy situations where they're sort of being bullied by their quote friend, right? You have to look at the patterns of her friendships to see, are they healthy or not? And of course, you know, all girls can have some unhealthy relationships here and there, but if it's a real pattern, it's something we need to take seriously.
And how great it is for you as the interviewer in that situation with the parent to be able to ask the right questions. That has to be an element of this, right? To be able to ask the right questions, because if you ask a parent, does she have friends? Sure, she has friends. All right, well, what do these relationships look like? And is she maintaining these relationships? And then even, like you said, taking it a step further, what are the ages of the friends that she has? And really taking that into account when you're looking at relationships and that social component.
Absolutely. Knowing how to interview is the key. That's a whole nother podcast because I could talk about that for an hour. And interviewing a teacher is key too, because so often the parents will tell me, yes, Jane is good friends with Susie. They're tight. They're great. We have no problems. And then I'll call the teacher and the teacher will say, yeah, Susie's really nice to Jane, but Susie's the most popular girl in the class and she's friends with everyone and Jane has no one and Jane gets mad when Susie plays with anyone else. Like you get the other side of
it. We do, right? Because as they get older, as the girls get older, is just really kind of across the board with any of our children, their self-reporting is that. It's the self-reporting and what is the accuracy of that. And if it's skewed with your interpretations of social interaction and relationship, your self-reporting is going to mirror just that, right? And so to ask the parents, but then the parents not in school to really observe this relationships that they're having. And so the parents like, oh yeah, she talks about friends. She talks about this person and that person. But then to have a professional that sees them in a different setting interact in that social way really, I think, would prove valuable.
Absolutely. There is zero chance I would ever do an autism evaluation or a social cognition evaluation and not interview the parent and a teacher, at least one teacher, and of course the girl herself. Because just yesterday I had a lovely 14-year-old and I did a long interview with her mother, who I think is forthcoming and psychologically healthy and a valid reporter and all that good stuff. Her mother doesn't really see her social problems. She sees a lot of anxiety, but not the social problems so much. But when I talked to this girl who, on my testing, she couldn't read facial expressions at all, and I asked her about it, and she said, yeah, I have no clue what any of it means. And I said, can you give me an example? And off the top of her head, she gave me like five examples. She said, well, so one day my friend had her head down on her desk and I didn't know if she was tired or sad and I didn't know how I was supposed to handle it. And so I just walked away from her. And I can never tell if somebody's laughing or crying. They look exactly the same to me. And my friends keep getting mad at me because I don't know. And my friends get mad at me because I don't say hello to them when I'm supposed to. This is now going back to that other. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, so if I see Mary in one class and then I see her in the very next class and I don't say hello to her, she gets mad at me. But I just saw her in the first class, right? So she just went on and on and on, and nobody had ever asked her about this stuff before. I could just feel the weight being lifted from her shoulders.
Well, she felt understood, right? She had somebody that understood and was able to know the questions to ask to get that right information.
Mom is lovely and super supportive, but just didn't happen to know how to ask the right questions exactly. Anyway, so we talk about relationships. Also with relationships, we look at things like social motivation, social flexibility, conflict management, all of that sort of thing. So again, it's much more complex than, does she have friends?
Right. And navigating that whole process. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the social flexibility and what that looks like in terms of reciprocity and play and being able to engage with our friends when they want to do something different than us. And which is, you know, a lot of that looks kind of more typical, but Jen, asking the right questions and really being that astute observer, probably able to see those nuances that we're talking about.
Right. Absolutely. So the third criteria under this category is nonverbal communication. And that includes things like eye contact and body language, personal space, sort of having too much or too little, orienting your body in the right direction, understanding other people's nonverbal cues like voice inflection and facial expressions, and also giving off your own nonverbal cues, you know, is like the girl I talked about at the very beginning, the one who was arrogant. A prior reporter had noted that she basically had flat affect. Well, sure, depression could cause flat affect, but if somebody, a child has flat affect more or less straight through their childhood, that's probably more than depression.
That's right.
So there's a lot to unpack there. I would say definitely one way that girls are different than boys in this category is with eye contact. They seem to learn at a younger age and better how to use eye contact. They just seem to get it. But again, if you ask them their experience of eye contact, you will hear that it is either uncomfortable or distracting. I've had so many girls say, eyes really creep me out. They really creep me out. It's just, I have to.
What is it about that? Do they say why?
They can't. I've asked a few times and I don't tend to push it because I'm clearly like hitting a nerve there. And in some ways it doesn't matter. What matters is their whole lives, adults have been forcing them to do something that creates a really negative sensation for them. And so, you know, it's important for the adults to understand, honestly, I know you think it's disrespectful, but she's going to listen to you better and engage with you better if you don't.
She's not feeling stressed. She's not creeped out. Yeah. And that's a gift within itself to be able to say, she's still hearing, she's processing, and she's actually going to respond, you know, in a more positive light because she doesn't have that stress element of having to look somebody in the eye.
Exactly. And, you know, recently I sent a survey to parents of girls I've diagnosed at the high end of the autism spectrum. Over the past 5 years, I sent it to 60 parents and 36 responded, which is a great response. And it was eye-opening in so many ways, but the overwhelming majority of them, 97%, first of all, agreed with the diagnosis, even though it had come as a surprise to them. And the overwhelming majority of them found it to be extremely helpful. Not for things like getting accommodations, that was barely ever mentioned, but for understanding their daughter, for understanding her emotions, her experience, how to interact with her. And these parents consistently in the survey wrote about, I asked, you know, how have things changed since the diagnosis? And they all talked about their personal experience of being less angry with her, less frustrated with her, less worried about her, more patient about her. Numerous people said things were better in their marriage and in the family as a whole.
These are understood.
Yeah, having this understanding doesn't just help this girl, it helps the whole family.
The whole system, right? The whole system that you can then have this understanding to use as a catalyst to grow that confidence and grow that individual to really the best version of themselves.
Absolutely.
And that's telling that so many of your families agreed with that diagnosis. And I'm sure it took a little bit for them to allow that to sink in and to process and unpack and say, well, now what? What does this mean? Because we've been told for so many years, it's this or it could be that. And so really figuring out what the answer is to then really start to form a solution.
For sure. For a lot of my folks, the diagnosis of autism comes as a real shock to them. But again, I only diagnose it when I have all of the data and I'm 100% sure. So I wasn't surprised that so many agreed after time had settled and they had a chance to read about it. That's the first group, is the social and communication piece, the reciprocity, relationships, and nonverbals. And you need to meet all three of those.
And that can be current or past.
Correct. And of course, I'm not going into them in great detail here. So the second group of criteria also has to be met currently or by history. And there are four. So we call it RRB, repetitive or restrictive behavior. And there are four criteria in this group. And you only have to meet two of the four. So that alone confuses people, because sometimes people hear, you know, oh, well, having sensory issues is a criteria. And so she's never had sensory issues, so she can't possibly have autism. But you only have to meet two of the four. So the first one is repetitive or unusual movement or language or use of objects.
That's what that looked like in girls. I think in my head, just, you know, from that special education lens, I have a very different picture. And I feel like you're going to explain. It helped me reframe my image in my head and really kind of help everybody listening of what that would look like.
Well, so what most people think that means is flapping arms or flicking hands or repeating, we call it echolalia, repeating what you just said or what somebody else just said. You know, remember Rain Man? And Tom Cruise would say, do you want to have dinner, Raymond? And Raymond would say, dinner, Raymond, dinner, Raymond, dinner, Raymond, that kind of thing. But when we're talking about girls at the neurotypical end of the spectrum, it can be pacing back and forth in the same spot or walking around in circles. I've had a lot of girls who just repeatedly walk around the kitchen island or walk around the sofa repeatedly. And I'm not talking about a girl who did this once when she was upset. I'm talking about it being repeated, of course. Walking around the edge of the playground, reading the same book or watching the same movie over and over and over again is a big one. And, you know, we've all read our favorite book more than once. I read Gone with the Wind about every 10 years or so. It's not reading your favorite book more than once. It's reading the same book or watching the same movie repeatedly or the same TV show repeatedly, that kind of thing. And then sort of having scripted behavior with language can be scripted. I had one daughter and the mom said, you know, every day I say, how was your day? And she says, fine. And how was whatever you did today? And for a long time, I thought, I didn't think anything of it. But then I realized she knows what I did during the day. And she always words it in that exact same way. How was whatever you did today? She can't alter it at all. It's 365 days a year she asked me that question.
It's kind of a flag of that just scripted language.
Exactly. So the repetitive or unusual movement can be certainly much more subtle and look differently in girls. And that's my clinical experience and also been shown in the research. The second criteria under this category is basically inflexibility. And what people think that means is having rigid routines and rituals. But it can be pockets of rigidity in many different ways. It can be getting stuck on perceptions or behavior, having inflexible approaches in school, sort of being stubborn on steroids, like there is nothing you can do to change this kid's perception or, you know, opinion. They won't work in class if they don't like the teacher. It can be about people. So I've had a lot of kids who just are very black and white about certain individuals. And so if they like their teacher, they're going to work hard. if they decide day one, I don't like that teacher, that's it. Doesn't matter what that teacher does all year long, not going to happen. And sometimes they can be very black and white about a younger sibling. I've seen this multiple times where they have one in particular younger sibling. And from day one, it's just hatred. It's all on warfare. It is far beyond typical sibling rivalry stuff. It ruins families where they can't take vacations together at all. So that's another way that sort of the rigidity can happen. It can happen with people. There can be rigid rule following. And so that gets missed a lot because these are like the best, most well-behaved kids you've ever seen. But there is such a thing as being too rigid with rule following. It's normal and reasonable to be able to cut corners. So I had he was maybe 12 years old. And I thought he had autism and nobody else did. And everybody disagreed with me, the excellent developmental pediatrician and the psychiatrist, and everybody disagreed. And now they all agree I was right. Ha ha. But when this happened, and I tell that story because I think it's important for people, if they really think a kid has autism, to stick to their guns and put it out there as a possibility and not just trust that, because so many great clinicians do miss it. So that's why I put that out there. But anyway, this kid was 12 and he was in the car one day with his family. His dad was driving and mom had to just like throw something in a mailbox. So they pulled into a handicapped parking spot for like 10 seconds. The mom was just getting out and getting in. The father wasn't even turning the car off, much less getting out of the car. And this really wonderful 12-year-old had a complete meltdown in the back seat because dad was breaking a rule. So that's what I mean by rigid rule following. It's really to that extent. With girls in general, girls internalize more than externalize. And that's true with this too, whereas a lot of boys that have rigidity will externalize it and have behavioral problems. The girls internalize it and it becomes perfectionism. And these girls bring perfectionism to an entirely new level. They drive themselves crazy. They can write a whole essay. And if they make one mistake, they're going to start the entire essay over again. That kind of thing. It can be really, really extreme perfectionism. So the third criteria under repetitive and restricted are interests. And these interests are restricted interests that can be either atypical or intense. And okay. So a lot of people think about interests being atypical. Like, you know, we've all met boys who are into airport codes or train schedules. So I certainly have girls with atypical interests, but much more frequently with girls, it's typical interests that are intense. And one of the most common ones is animals.
Okay.
Another really common one is actually reading. And sometimes parents look at me funny when I say, does she ever read too much? But there is such a thing as too much reading, believe it or not. If she's getting in trouble at school because she's always reading instead of paying attention, if she's always having to bring a book to the dinner table, if the family takes a walk and she brings a book and reads while she's walking. I had a girl once who was reading in the shower, not the bath, the shower.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. If she's missing sleep because she's reading. So, you know, a lot of girls love to read and obviously that's fantastic. But there is such a thing as an intense interest in reading, and it's definitely something to take seriously and pay attention to. Other really common intense interests are anime, K-pop has been big, makeup or fashion.
Which all of these items blend, right? Like you would say, oh, well, this is a typical peer, she's into this and just a teenage phase, or, I mean, it would be really easy to just kind of dismiss that as being something different.
Right, absolutely. And obviously the trick is deciding whether or not it's intense, right? And so that can sometimes get tricky. And I would never base a diagnosis of autism on an intense interest in reading, for instance. It would have to be in the context of social challenges and the other criteria.
And has to fit all the other criteria. What does intense, you gave some good ideas with reading. What does intense look like makeup, K-pop?
So I had a girl who had an intense interest in makeup. And anytime she got any money, she, like for Christmas or her birthday, 100% of it went to makeup. She has accumulated an unbelievable amount of makeup. She also likes to organize it, which is a whole nother thing. And she puts makeup on and takes it off and puts it on and takes it off and puts it on and takes, she loves to play with it, but she never ever wears makeup, like to school, out of the house, family goes out to dinner. She never ever wears it. It's not about that, you know, and she's not isolated. I've definitely seen other girls with that kind of thing. I had another girl with an intense interest in cats. Every conversation, no matter what I brought up, the conversation was going to end up being back on cats. At one point I broke out a bunch of toys and we had a few different animals and there weren't any cats, but she turned them into cats. She said, okay, we're just going to pretend that these are cats. Like everything was cats. And you're probably picturing a young girl now. She was 16 when I saw her, maybe 17. She must've been 17 because she had gone on some college visits and she liked to dress like a cat. Like she put on a cat collar and had little cat ears and she went on her formal college visits in her cat gear. So that's the intense, right? Yeah. So then the last repetitive restricted one is sensory. So this is the one criteria of all of them that I have not noticed a major difference between boys and girls, nor have I read anything about it in the research. So there may be a difference with the genders, but I don't know of it yet. The only thing I can say is that, again, girls internalize more where boys externalize more. So with a girl, you really have to ask her, you know, if things bother her or if things make her irritable. Just yesterday, I'll keep talking about this same girl because she's on my mind. The mother said, no, there's no history of sensory stuff that I know of. And the girl gave me a list of things that like make her really, really irritable, from like the sound of winter coats, the sound of the teacher writing on the whiteboard. It was mostly
sensory. But she never expressed verbally to her parents or people around her. And so mom's just thinking she's not reacting to her winter coat being put on. So that's not a concern, but she's held that in.
That's exactly right. And this girl is unbelievably anxious. I mean, she has been in therapy. She's about 14. She's been in therapy nonstop since she was 5 with really good therapists. She's been on antidepressants, anti-anxiety, just because her anxiety is huge. And now we understand why, what's going on underneath. And she doesn't share, even though her mom is a super supportive, you know, lady. Part of the reciprocity is just sharing personal information, right? And she doesn't think to share that information with her mother or anyone else.
But now I'm sure then she can get more directive support because people can then ask. Is that right? Like just in terms of if you're not sharing, then nobody knows. But now that if we know, then we can ask the right questions to kind of go through a process to help you become more comfortable with these sensory stimuli around you, I would think, right?
Exactly. And also teaching her, see, your life gets a little easier when you share these things. That's one of the reasons to start talking, because ultimately we want these girls to be able to self-advocate. They are at higher risk to be in abusive relationships when they're older. And so we really, and for that and obviously a million other reasons, we want them to learn self-advocacy, to be aware of what's going on with them, and to know how to talk to a trusted person about it. It's of the utmost importance.
Excellent point. That is really, you know, in just terms of healthy relationships and to have that self-awareness so that you can then have the skills to advocate and communicate what you need and want. And that's what we want for all of our kiddos. So out of the 3 symptoms and then 2 of the 4 symptoms, have you kind of just anecdotally seen elements that maybe are not specifically listed, but there's elements that pop out as girls and women that you think, through my practice or through my readings and research, I kind of see these factors that may be part of it that, you know, maybe you want other clinicians to know or other parents to know? Kind of just as, again, this is not, hey, if they have this one thing, then yes, they could be a girl or a woman with autism, but just to be able to say, you know, kind of start threading these together.
Yeah. So I think you're asking me kind of, what are some red flags? What are things right to be on the lookout for, besides obviously the things we've talked about? And I want to give you some, but before I do that, I just want to be clear. There are 2 other criteria that are important to mention. the two groups, the social communication and the repetitive restricted. But it also, there's a criteria that, of course, it has to start in childhood. This is not something that begins in adulthood. But for girls, it could start in middle school. It shows itself in middle school. I mean, you're either born with autism or you're not. You don't get it later in life. But for a lot of these girls, they hold themselves together well through elementary school. And then everything goes nutty when they hit middle school, and girl world gets really nutty, right? A lot of times parents and clinicians think, well, it couldn't possibly be autism because it didn't start until sixth grade. But if you look carefully, you'll find evidence of it before then. It's just that she was holding it together just enough that nobody really knew what was going on. So that's an important piece. And then the last criteria is simply that it has to cause some difficulty in functioning. So it can be social functioning, it can be the anxiety, it can be, you know, behavior, but that's an important one because I won't diagnose someone if they meet all the criteria, but they're doing really, really well. They have their nerdy group of friends and they're happy and they're not, you know, they don't have an anxiety disorder and they're getting decent grades. Then I won't necessarily diagnose because there are plenty of adults out there walking around with ASPE brains and they're doing just fine, right? And you probably know some and I know some, and that you don't necessarily need a diagnosis if you have an ASPE brain. You know, I think about, I don't know, people like Dan Aykroyd, you know, and he's diagnosed with Asperger's. So presumably he had trouble, but you know, there's so many high functioning people out there. So there's that piece too.
Well, I think it goes even to the education world in terms of what is the, you know, just from that educational special education lens, you know, is there an impact? And then if there is, then we would definitely support that student. But kind of to your point that if it's not an impact, that there are these symptoms and we see these patterns, but it's not impacting them, then diagnosing is really not going to change the course of their events.
Right. That's exactly right. That's a great way to think about it. There has to be impact for it to be sort of diagnosis worthy. Absolutely. And so sometimes I'll just say, you know, we don't need to diagnose, but I'll still talk about it so that the child and the parents understand themselves through that lens.
Which makes sense, because then if, you know, if things start to surface down the road, then they have that nugget of knowledge that they can then say, oh, all right, this maybe is why this is surfacing, and what are some steps that we could take so that it is not impacting my daily success.
That is exactly right. Because quite often, sooner or later, something happens where, you know, it will be helpful to have that perspective for sure. But sorry, getting back to your question about red flags. So I guess I'll put them into three categories. So the first would be social concerns. Besides the obvious, like she's socially awkward or she can't make friends, what I would look for is a change in middle school. So around fifth or sixth or seventh grade, somewhere in that range, some fundamental change where she seemed to be doing well and now she isn't. Now, we all know middle school is the hardest time. You ask any woman, what was the hardest point of your life? And half of them will say middle school, right? So just because she has social difficulty in middle school doesn't mean, of course, she has autism, but it's something to pay attention to. If she is persistently friends with kids who are either significantly younger or significantly older, rather than same age peers, if she is persistently friends with quirky kids or a certain type of kid, or she has difficulty in her relationships, if she's really naive or really immature, if she's overly controlling with her friends, and so there are a lot of fights, or she's overly flexible and her friends maybe take advantage of her, if she's been bullied or teased, if her interests start to seem immature. Last week, I worked with a 15-year-old who's still into Barbie dolls, you know? Again, none of these things in and of themselves mean autism, but they are all red flags that somebody at least needs to pause and think about it. Emotionally, if there is really persistent anxiety or depression and it's not responding to treatment, and it also doesn't make sense, like there's no trauma history, the parents are super supportive, you know, it's just something to think about. If she has a lot of trouble talking about her feelings, a lot of these girls have poor interoceptive awareness. They're not aware what they're feeling is anxiety, for instance. And they tend to be really poor therapy candidates, some of them, for that reason. They sort of can shut down in therapy. If there's a premature diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which happens a lot, which I can't even go down that road, but pediatric bipolar is unbelievably exceedingly rare. So if a child is diagnosed with that, that is something I would want to sort of pause and think through, what else could that be? And definitely school refusal, which is a major symptom or sign of anxiety. Other things to look for, definitely chronic GI problems, which could be sort of a way of expressing anxiety, but also could be very real because people on the spectrum do tend to have more GI problems. Also could be chronic headaches. And these may or may not be an attempt to avoid school. Usually I find that these kids are truly in pain. In the history, having an older dad, for sure. I recently heard also having an older mom, older meaning after 40 at age of conception. Seizures in the history. You know, these are little red flags. Honestly, a lot of times it's you hear a story and these parents have been chasing a diagnosis their whole life in terms of trying to understand their daughter. They maybe first took her to, you know, the infants and toddlers program because she was maybe a little bit awkward with her motor movements. And then she had some little sensory stuff in kindergarten and they took her to for some OT. And then maybe she had a little anxiety in third grade and they took her for some therapy. And then in fifth grade, she got diagnosed with ADHD. And it's sort of been one thing after another her whole entire life. When I see that situation, I think, we need to at least pause and think, could there be autism like underlying all of this?
What would be the biggest takeaway from our conversation that you would want clinicians, parents, educators, anybody that's listening, kind of what is the takeaway of this understanding girls with autism?
I really want clinicians to know a few things. Number one, you can't rely on clinical intuition to just know if a girl has autism. 25 years ago, I had this idea that I would just know. It would be obvious as soon as I walk into my waiting room whether or not a kid had autism because they would be overtly odd. They wouldn't make eye contact. They would want to talk about airport codes. You know, they'd be flicking their hands. And that is absolutely positively not the case. One-on-one in your office, these girls can be incredibly engaging, polite, have all the basic social niceties. So don't rely on clinical intuition, number one. Number two, don't rely on other professionals, even those that you respect. Even if it's me, you know, I'm quite sure I've missed girls with autism in the past. And so even if another clinician says, no, this girl can't have autism, if you are wondering it, it's okay to question that clinician, to call them and say, can you help me understand why you think she doesn't? Because this is what I'm seeing. And at least have the conversation. I've had that conversation seriously no fewer than 100 times. And it's usually quite productive because, you know, we really end up having a meaningful conversation about the girl. And I think it can be really helpful. So just because somebody else said, no, it couldn't possibly be autism, don't let that stop you from wondering. I read a ton of neuropsych reports, and quite often it's either not brought up at all, it's never addressed, or they rule out autism for some reason that makes no sense. Like she, and I swear these are honest examples that I have read in neuropsych reports or reports from psychiatrists. She clearly doesn't have autism because she made eye contact with me. She clearly doesn't have autism because she has a good sense of humor. She clearly doesn't have autism because she has friends. She clearly doesn't have autism because I found her to be delightful and engaging. So these are all real examples that I've seen repeatedly. And so that's not a reason to rule out autism for these girls who, by the way, often have fantastic senses of humor. So what else do I want clinicians to know? Don't let prior diagnoses explain too much. It's easy to get in that rut of, well, yeah, she doesn't have friends because she's anxious. But if that's going on year after year, at some point you have to stop and ask yourself, well, why is she so anxious? And could there be something else going on here? And not just accept an old explanation if she's not getting better. Don't let your own lack of confidence stop you from wondering about autism. That's a big one. I just meet so many clinicians of varying backgrounds, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, learning specialists, speech pathologists, OTs, who feel like, well, I just don't know enough about autism to even think about this or wonder about it. Don't let it stop you. If you're noticing some of these things and it pops into your mind, talk to another clinician involved, obviously with the parent's consent. Bring it up, talk about it. It's unbelievably important. That's true for teachers as well. And for those of you who are mental health professionals who actually will, you know, can and will pursue an autism diagnosis at times, remember you have to dig deeper and dig differently. Simply sort of running through the criteria. Does she have friends? Does she make eye contact? Has she ever had sensory stuff? Does she flap her hands? It's not going to cut it. It just isn't.
Taking that deeper dive and really kind of having that awareness of what that can look like, the differences, the sensitivity of the nature, the grace to then be able to communicate and collaborate, you know, with and on part for parents, teachers, and clinicians, I think would be the takeaway, right? In terms of just, I really like how you said that, just take pause, dive a little deeper when you have a question mark, and then ask questions, ask other people that are working with that child to see, could it be something different? And why, you know, why are we kind of chasing different elements and things aren't really aligning? And then taking that pause and that step back with that sensitivity and grace to then be able to explore and see if we can come up with an answer that seems to be a better match for what we're seeing throughout the day and throughout the lifespan.
Yep, absolutely. And every time I do a talk like this, whether it's live or recorded, usually one or two people in the weeks afterwards reach out to me by email and say, hey, I have a girl I'm thinking about, but I'm not really confident. I'm okay to spend, you know, a short amount of time talking to people about their current patients, just generally, and just sort of giving them some ways to think about specific girls. So if people have somebody they're wondering about and they're not sure, they can feel free to email me, you know, set up a short phone call and chat about it. I'm happy to do that, you know, wherever they're located.
Do you have an email that you'd like to share?
Sure. D Henderson, just my first initial, last name, at sticksrude.com. That's S as in Sam, T as in Tom, IXRUD as in Donna, sticksrude.com. And my website is drdonnahenderson.com.
And you can find more information.
Yeah, you can reach me through my website.
I love it. Dr. Henderson, this has been such a pleasure and an eye-opening and informative. And I hope that this conversation reaches other clinicians and parents and educators just so that they can stay informed and to be able to better support all the kiddos that are around us. So absolutely, I thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. Take care, Wendy.
Thanks so much for listening to this listener favorite episode on the Special Ed Strategist podcast. If Dr. Henderson's insights gave you a new perspective, please take a moment to like, follow, and share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Want more tools and support? Visit me at learningessentialsedu.com or connect on Instagram at learningessentials. You're not alone, and you're doing amazing work. See you next time.